I learned that our friends on the astral plane are aware of our difficulty in bringing the memory of their world back into the physical conditions, and in consequence, they cooperate with us before we leave the astral in an endeavor to present the impressions of what we have experienced there, or the guidance we may have received in some form which might survive the disintegrating effect of the dream condition through which they knew we would probably pass before waking. The form which most easily survived was one that could be incorporated with, or woven into, the dream in a symbolical form such as could be more or less easily interpreted by the mind when it awakes in the physical body. A careful study of these forms will repay the student, and open up a new and interesting field of investigation into the power of the mind, both conscious and subconscious. Our willpower plays an important part in this branch of the subject. By recognizing the fact that our spirit cooperators on the astral are endeavoring to assist us to bring back some helpful material from their plane, we can gradually train our minds to accept and retain whatever is beneficial to us, and it seems to elude the destructive elements in the dream world better if it is disguised in symbolical form. Why these destructive elements exist, I don't know. It may be that they arise out of our subconscious collection of fears, inhibitions and failings which well up during sleep, but a persistent desire to reach out and hold on to that which is constructive and beneficial ultimately overcomes the tendency of the subconscious to interfere. As in everything else, practice makes perfect, and eventually overcomes all obstacles. This is especially true in the field of astral investigation. At one period I was being very perturbed by family matters, which threatened to bring about a very serious and undesirable crisis unless something intervened to prevent it. Time was becoming short, the crisis seemed to draw nearer. It seemed almost impossible to avert it, and though we who were directly concerned knew we were in the right, yet everything seemed to be going wrong for us. There seemed no step that we could take to avoid the calamity we feared. One morning I awoke, and immediately brought back a very clear memory of having been in the astral world with my husband. What I had heard or seen there, I could not remember, but on leaving it I had passed into a dream state, and my husband had accompanied me into it. In the dream state I saw a cricket field, and lying on the ground were some stumps and a mallet. My husband went to the stumps, picked up two, and stuck them in the ground. To my amazement I saw that they were at least 6 feet high, and I thought to myself, they are too large for him to hit properly, but my husband took up the mallet, looked round at me with a reassuring grin, lifted the mallet, and with a few well-aimed blows he knocked the stumps right into the ground, until they almost disappeared. He turned and grinned again. "I've knocked those two on the head," he said, with deep satisfaction. As I awoke, this incident was clear in every detail in my mind, and I immediately realized that the stumps were the two people who were causing the trouble that had hurt us so deeply. Remember, it is important to seek the symbolical meaning of the dream as soon as possible after waking, because the mind is more susceptible to the true interpretation before it begins to register the impressions from the mundane world into which we are awakening. The certainty that the symbolical interpretation I had placed on this dream was the true one, sustained and helped me through the critical days of waiting until we knew what would be decided in our case. Within a very short time the statement that the two people were being knocked on the head was verified. That was exactly what happened in the end, and everything came to a happy conclusion all round. No one was hurt. The knocking on the head led to a change of mind in the right direction very suddenly, and, in the normal sense of the word, unexpectedly, though not to me. Indeed, I should have been very surprised if it had not so happened, for I had begun to find that one is never misled when one has learned to distinguish the real significance in dreams of this type. On another occasion I had to tackle a business matter which had become very troublesome owing to the attitude of one person concerned in it. This person was renting some premises from me, and in order to force me to make some concessions that would have been grossly unfair to me, and quite outside the terms of our contract, she said she was going to vacate the house, and leave it on my hands at what was an extremely difficult time for such a thing to happen. She was aware of this fact, and exploited it to the fullest extent. I felt quite helpless about the matter, and went to bed one night after having prayed that I might get some light given me in dealing with this unpleasant and difficult problem. Once again I visited the astral plane, but probably because of my perturbed mental condition, I could not remember what had happened, except that I had received some spiritual comfort and sustenance there. I passed into the dream state, and dreamed that I saw a dog approaching me. I am very fond of animals, and am not particularly nervous even of strange dogs. However, this one approached me in an obviously unfriendly spirit. I noticed it was a light ginger color, and as it came nearer it bared its teeth, and snarled in a most unpleasant way. It advanced with the apparent intention of attacking me. My husband, who had seemingly accompanied me from the astral back into the dream, stood beside me, and as the dog approached, he said, "Don't worry, it can't bite you, it's only pretending to do so." I immediately awoke, and remembered that the hair of the dog was of the same color as that of the person who was causing me so much anxiety. Absurd as it may appear, there was also some definite yet subtle resemblance to her in the dog in other ways as well as the hair, which was of a pronounced and uncommon shade. I acted on the assumption that my adversary could not bite me. I ignored her threats, and very soon proved that all her threatening tactics had been mere bluff, as she had realized the awkward position I should be placed in if she carried out her threat, and she had relied on my giving in to any unjust demand rather than face the alternative. Directly she realized that her conduct had no effect whatever on me, my dream upheld me and gave me confidence, she capitulated, and I had no further trouble in the matter. A question arises as to how these symbols are given to, or received by us in these dreams. Do we, ourselves, manufacture them mentally? If so, how do we know what kind of symbol would be of most use to us as a warning or premonition? Are they chosen for us by other beings, discarnate souls who are living in the great beyond, and who may know more than we do about the events that are likely to affect us in the immediate future? If these souls are bound to us by ties of affection and mutual interest, it is possible that we discuss some of our problems with them on their own plane, and that illumination and guidance are received by us, not on trivial personal matters, but on those larger issues which may affect our work and progress. I think this latter hypothesis may well be the true one, and that when we endeavor to bring the understanding we have gained through to the physical body, we find that we cannot bring the meaning through intact, and our own minds cooperate with those of our spirit helpers in making a selection of suitable symbols that will be easily understood by us on waking. For instance, if the dreamer had a horror of drowning, that might be selected as a particular warning symbol. Another person might react in some definite manner to the idea of falling, flying, rain clouds, stones, knives, or many other things. As we draw near to our physical bodies after visiting one of the astral planes, memory of all we have seen and heard on these planes often seems to fade as we approach the physical. As our etheric body approaches the physical counterpart, the astral cord becomes shorter and thicker, and less elastic, and it is in my experience that when it has diminished to a few feet in length, sometimes a little more or less consciousness and memory are apartment to cease to operate. Why this is so, I do not know. I say apartment to cease to operate because there are occasions when the consciousness is carried intact from the etheric into the physical, even when the etheric is functioning at short distance range, and a complete memory of all that has occurred is brought forward into the physical brain. Probably the selection of symbols that would best suit the case is made on the etheric plane, and a mental picture is made up of them by ourselves and our spirit friends, so that should we, on nearing the physical, lose our consciousness of the astral scene we have taken part in, and even perhaps of the very mental pictures we decided upon, our spirit cooperators, who have not forgotten, can present the picture to us just before, or as, we are waking. They give it to us as a strong mental image, or series of images, throwing them on our brain like a magic lantern throws a picture on a screen, or it may be described as a form of astral hypnotism. One of my pet horrors is any kind of crawling things, such as spiders, beetles, snakes, etc. I am far more frightened of them than I should be of a wolf or other wild and supposedly fierce animal. This idiosyncrasy of mine was used to good effect one night in the form of a symbolical dream. I was away from home at the time, having a specially pleasant holiday in the quiet, restful home of a friend at Bath. While there, I felt that I should probably contact my husband in the etheric world, and bring back the memory. One night I became aware that I had succeeded in projecting my etheric body, and also that I had managed to visit some higher plane, where I had seen and talked to my husband. On returning, I had lost the memory of what had actually happened there, and felt very disappointed. Then I found I was passing into a dream state, and that my husband was somewhere near, though I could no longer see him. In front of, and quite close to me, was a large, venomous-looking snake. It reared, and deliberately thrust its head toward me to strike me. As it did so, I put out my hand, and rested it on the creature's slimy, repulsive-looking head. Afterwards I remembered with amazement that I had felt no horror, or even aversion, but only an intense feeling of pity. I found myself saying while I fondled its head, "You poor thing. You can't hurt me. Oh, you poor thing." It did not bite me, its head sank down, and I immediately awoke in my physical body, remembering the episode in every detail, though I was aware that some astral experience had preceded it which I had forgotten. I felt impressed that the snake was a symbolical meaning to me of something about to happen, of which I must not allow myself to be frightened. The next day I returned home, traveling on a Sunday. My house was empty, as it was my maid's day out, so I quickly unpacked, and disposed of my luggage, and went into my sitting room, where a large pile of letters awaited my attention. I opened a few at random, and then feeling rather tired after the journey, I thought I would only open one more. I picked up one which I could see was in the handwriting of a friend whom I had been asked to help, and previous to my visit to Bath I had been endeavoring to do so. I had only known her a short time, but she was a most interesting and attractive personality, though an invalid for some years. When I looked at the words at the beginning of the letter, my senses reeled. Some of the foulest accusations that one human being could level at another were contained in that letter. Horrible, poisonous, appalling statements. It was unbelievable. Never had I thought it possible that a human mind could frame such accusations, and as I read, I discovered to my further horror, that they were directed to me, referred to me unmistakably. I felt myself go cold and faint with horror at the awful words that stared at me from the notepaper. I literally found my legs could not support me, and as I sank back into a chair that fortunately happened to be just beside me, the dream of the snake came back like a picture flashed suddenly into my mind from without. Simultaneously, I knew that the snake symbolized the writer of the letter, and I remembered how I had known the snake could not and did not really want to hurt me. And at once my feelings completely changed, and I felt all aversion and repugnance immediately vanish, leaving only the deep sense of pity I had felt for the creature in my dream. I definitely tried to visualize the writer of the letter and mentally extended my hand to her, placing it on her head, just as I had done with the snake. For the rest of the evening I felt uplifted and comforted, but I made up my mind to get to the bottom of the awful mystery. I did so with the help of a friend who lived nearer to the writer than I did, and we discovered that this poor soul had become mentally deranged through the inroads of old age and long-standing disease, which had ultimately and rather suddenly reached the brain, and that she had made these terrible accusations against several of her friends, especially those, strange as it may seem, to whom she was specially attached. I should mention here that the letter had been written to me on the day preceding my dream, and I feel sure that my husband, and perhaps other discarnate friends, knew about it, and realized the shock it would give me, and helped to warn me by suggesting the dream. I have since had many repetitions of these kinds of dream experiences, and think they can be cultivated when once we are mentally open to their possibilities and significance. Chapter 22. Animals and their etheric bodies. There is no doubt whatever that we are beginning to realize the existence of the etheric body, and many scientists and serious investigators have given a good deal of time and attention to the matter during recent years. Much has been written on the subject of the aura, which has been detected, and even photographed by a certain apparatus fitted with a special lens. Some people are gifted with a range of vision which seems to extend to a lesser or greater degree some distance farther than other normally sighted people can see. Those who can do this often describe the aura as being luminous and colored. The colors seem to vary somewhat, and include all the colors in the spectrum, but I have noticed there is a prevalence of different shades of gold, ranging from the palest yellow to a deep, brilliant reddish shade, and also of violet or purple, and its many varying tones. I am sure that the aura is an emanation from the etheric body, and not from the physical, as some people appear to imagine. There is some curious magnetic quality about it. Though I cannot often see the aura myself, I have been keenly aware of the magnetic power from it, and without turning round, I could feel that someone had come up noiselessly, and I could also sense to some extent the type of person, or the emotional or temperamental qualities they might possess. This power of sensing without seeing may be labeled psychic by many people. This word is now used to include whole multitudes of nebulous and vague suppositions. The dictionary definition given to it is, belonging to the human soul, spirit, or mind, and we can easily understand that the existence of the etheric body, which is the house of the soul, can be felt even when it cannot be seen objectively. Though the dictionary uses the term human soul, I have heard convincing proof that animals also possess etheric bodies, which can manifest themselves during their physical life on Earth, as well as after death, though to a somewhat more limited extent than the human can. I have felt a strong emanation from the body of an animal of whose presence I was unaware until I felt the electrical power coming from a certain direction. I have looked down, under the table, for instance, and found that a dog or cat had come into the room unperceived by me, and was standing or sitting in exactly the spot from which I had felt the magnetic current. If we admit that animals possess an etheric body, we may suppose that this body will exist after death. I have had what to me was convincing evidence that animals do continue to live, and that their minds and memories function very much as those of human beings, in relation to their friends on Earth. I will relate one very striking example of after-death survival and manifestation of animal life. I have had several such, but this particular one happened recently and is very clear in my mind. For many years my husband and I owned a very intelligent, domineering, autocratic, disobedient, belligerent, and withal lovable Pekingese. Doesn't this description fit the majority of the breed? 11 years ago she died at the age of 14. My husband was profoundly attached to this dog, whom we had called Ching, regardless of the fact that it was a female. A few weeks ago I was awakened from a sound sleep by feeling something moving about on my bed, close to my right shoulder. I was lying on my left side, a little on my face. Whatever it was on the bed was patting or pawing my shoulder. I was rather startled for a moment, as the touch was so solid and definite. Remembering that nothing evil could touch me so long as I myself realize the paramount power of good, I pulled myself together, and tried to put my left hand and arm, on which I had been partly lying, out from under the bedclothes, and to reach back over my right shoulder in an endeavor to touch whatever it was that was touching me. In doing this I found, as had happened before in such cases, that I was partly cataleptic. The room was not quite dark. I could see the fireplace, mantelpiece, and cupboard door opposite me. Making a tremendous mental effort, I managed to extend my hand out and back over my shoulder. Anybody who has had a similar experience will understand how difficult a feat it is to move about at all during the cataleptic condition. If it is very deep, it is impossible to move at all for the time being. But even if one is only partly so, it feels as if the limbs are weighted with lead when we attempt to move them. However, I succeeded, and my hand came into contact with a fluffy, furry object. Also, with an effort, I managed to ask, "Is it Ching?" The effort to move and speak was so great that I soon lost the power to do so, and collapsed into a deeper cataleptic state. My arm and hand dropped back again, and every limb stiffened. As this was happening, I became conscious that my etheric body was moving slightly out from my physical, and I realized that my consciousness was beginning to operate in both bodies simultaneously. I have explained in a previous chapter that this phenomenon can take place under certain conditions, especially when this state of catalepsy is present. Though my physical body was lying on its left side, facing the fireplace, which I could still see distinctly, I could now see, equally clearly, the foot and the right-hand side of the bed, to which my physical back was turned, and part of the room which was shut off from my range of physical vision. A curious feature of these circumstances is that one seems to see the etheric objects with about the same or only slightly more clarity than that with which one sees the physical, which is in great contrast to the vividness with which one sees surrounding objects when one is entirely dissociated from the physical. The darkness of the room appears to affect the etheric vision to about the same extent as it does the physical. This, I think, may be entirely due to the cataleptic condition which limits the faculty of sight in the etheric body while it is so closely associated with the physical counterpart. As one is seeing in both bodies simultaneously, it may well be that the amount of consciousness of seeing is halved. As I say, this is usually more noticeable when the subject is in a state of entire or partial catalepsy, which I have found customary when power is being taken from us by the etheric operators in order to produce some definite manifestation on the physical plane. As soon as I became aware that my faculty of sight was operating in my etheric body, and that I could see and feel without moving my physical body, I gave up all effort, and prepared myself to observe carefully anything that might happen. At the foot of the bed I saw my husband standing. He was regarding with great interest the antics of the moving object on my bed. Now I could use my etheric arm, and I put it on the furry object, and recognized at once the form of my little Pekingis. I passed my etheric hand over head, back, and under her chest. When she realized that I was doing so, she nearly went mad with delight. She plunged, and leapt, and rolled over. As she rolled on my hand, I felt that she weighed about the same as she had in her earthly life. The soft silky hair on her chest, and the long, hanging ears were the same. I remembered how, long ago, she used to plunge about and roll over on my hand while I was trying to stroke her when I awoke in the mornings, and she knew that at last the time had arrived when I would speak to her and touch her again after the long night's silence. During this time I could see both my husband and the dog, and though the light from the window was dim, I noticed there was a kind of faint, luminous glow in the vicinity of my husband's body, and that of the dog. As I fondled her, my husband answered the question I had asked when I first tried to touch her, saying, "Yes, it is Ching," as if he was afraid I should doubt the evidence of my own senses unless he assured me that it was really so. As always, after such an experience, I felt comforted and soothed. I did not seek to prolong the experience, but mentally asking a blessing on my husband and Ching, and giving heartfelt thanks for the inestimable boon of their visit to me, then I gave up conscious control of my etheric body, and after a moment or two's quiet reflection in my physical body of all that had happened, I sank into a deep, restful, and dreamless sleep till morning came. Chapter 23. Important scientific corroboration. In the early part of this present year 1937, a most important record of an out-of-the-body experience was read by no less a person than Sir Auckland Geddes to the members of the Royal Medical Society. It was the occasion of the bicentenary of that society, and was fully recorded in the Scotsman and also in the issue of the Edinburgh Medical Journal for June 1937. This record contained remarkable corroboration of many of my own experiences, some of which I have already related to you. But one, the crowning and most uplifting manifestation that has ever come my way, I have reserved for a later chapter in this book. Sir Auckland Geddes described the document which he read as the experience of a man who had passed into the very portals of death, and retained his full consciousness while out of his body. And when medical treatment forced his etheric body to return to the physical, he brought back a complete and detailed memory of all he had seen and done in the etheric. The record was immediately taken down by a skilled secretary. Sir Auckland Geddes said the existence of the records had been known to some of the teachers in the society, but he requested that anyone who knew to whom this strange experience befell would respect the anonymity and professional secrecy in which the communication was veiled. Sir Auckland then proceeded to read the following extract from the record. On Saturday, November 9th, a few minutes after midnight, I began to feel very ill, and by 2 o'clock was definitely suffering from acute gastroenteritis, which kept me vomiting and purging until about 8 o'clock. By 10 o'clock I had developed all the symptoms of very acute poisoning, intense gastrointestinal pain, diarrhea, pulse and respirations becoming quite impossible to count. I wanted to ring for assistance, but found I could not, and so quite placidly gave up the attempt. I realized I was very ill, and very quickly reviewed my whole financial position. Thereafter, at no time did my consciousness appear to me to be in any way dimmed, but I suddenly realized that my consciousness was separating from another consciousness, which was also me. These, for purposes of description, we could call the A and B consciousness, and throughout what follows, the ego attached itself to the A consciousness. The B personality I recognized as belonging to the body, and as my physical condition grew worse and the heart was fibrillating rather than beating, I realized that the B consciousness belonging to the body was beginning to show signs of becoming composite, that is, built up of consciousness from the head, the heart, the viscera, and C. These components became more individual, and the B consciousness began to disintegrate, while the A consciousness, which was now me, seemed to be altogether outside my body, which it could see. Gradually I realized that I could see not only my body and the bed in which it was, but everything in the whole house and garden, and then I realized that I was seeing not only things at home, but in London and in Scotland, in fact wherever my attention was directed it seemed to me, and the explanation which I received, from what source I do not know, but which I found myself calling to myself my mentor, was that I was free in a time dimension of space, wherein now was in some way equivalent to here in the ordinary three-dimensional space of everyday life. I next realized that my vision included not only things in the ordinary three-dimensional world, but also things in these four or more dimensional places that I was in. From now on the description is and must be entirely metaphorical, because there are no words which really describe what I saw, or rather appreciated. Although I had no body, I had what appeared to be perfect to-eyed vision, and what I saw can only be described in this way, that I was conscious of a psychic stream flowing with life through time, and this gave me the impression of being visible, and it seemed to me to have particularly intense iridescence. I understood from my mentor that all our brains are just end organs projecting as it were from the three-dimensional universe into the psychic stream, and flowing with it into the fourth and fifth dimensions. Around each brain, as I saw it, there seemed to be what I can only describe in ordinary words as a condensation of the psychic stream, which formed in each case as though it were a cloud, only it was not a cloud. While I was just appreciating this, the mentor who was conveying information to me explained that the fourth dimension was in everything existing in the three-dimensional space, and at the same time everything in the three-dimensional space existed in the fourth dimension, and also in the fifth dimension, and I at the time quite clearly understood what was meant, and quite understood how now in the fourth dimensional universe was just the same to all intents and purposes as here in a three-dimensional universe, that is to say a four-dimensional being was everywhere in the now just as one is everywhere in the here in a three-dimensional view of things. I then realized that I myself was a condensation, as it were, in the psychic stream, a sort of cloud that was not a cloud, and the visual impression I had of myself was blue. Gradually I began to recognize people, and I saw the psychic condensation attached to A, B, C, D, E, F, and to quite a number of men that I knew, especially to G and H. In addition I saw quite a number of people that I know had very little psychic condensation at all attached to them. In addition to those just mentioned, I saw I very clearly, and she also gave a visual impression of blueness. A gave purple and dark red, B pink, D rather indefinite grey brown, E pearly, and F apricot colour, G was definitely brown. Each of these condensations varied from all others in bulk, sharpness of outline, and apparent solidity. Just as I was beginning to grasp all these, I saw her enter my bedroom. I realized she got a terrible shock, and I saw her hurry to the telephone. I saw my doctor leave his patients and come very quickly, and heard him say, or saw him think, "He is nearly gone." I heard him quite clearly speaking to me on the bed, but I was not in touch with the body, and could not answer him. I was really cross when he took a syringe and rapidly injected my body with something which I afterwards learned was camphor.